Accession number 32390, Mr. Harold Checkett's Reel 3. So what happened to you down below then? So the ship took on a list, but you're pretty locked in down there, aren't you?
You were very locked in down there, yes. You were down below, and we gradually became redundant, in a sense, because the equipment we'd got, of course, wasn't doing anything because the 14-inch wasn't doing anything. And then when the power was lost for the anti-aircraft, that gradually meant that they were sort of doing things to the extent that they could on their own. Just left, they had enough power, I think, to swing round and so on, but not to get the sort of accurate aims that, one would hope that they could, and shooting down, because I don't know whether we shot as many as five Japanese planes down. I don't really know. And of course, I wasn't witness to any of these things. And we just had to sit there and wait.
Horrible.
Wait and wait until it was realized that the ship was in such a bad way it was going to go down, like the Repulse had already gone down. And I think it was at least half an hour longer that we were just sitting there. But the odd thing was that after the Repulse had gone down, and then while we were being going to be taken on board gradually, some people were free to go and get on board one of our destroyers tied up on the after side of the ship, and the Prince was, of course, heeling over. And this destroyer was down aft, and actually at one point it started sliding down the side of the Prince. And that was, we had about four main destroyers, that was the Express. There was the Express and the Electra and the Tenedos, and there was another one, I can't remember.
So had you come on deck by this time?
No, we came on deck, when everyone else was freed. The captain walked around, I gather, and told people if they weren't any longer needed by the that would have been the 14-inch, they could go and get onto the Express, and. Then I'd forgotten the exact time of abandoned ship, and it was even sometime after that the ship went down.
You boarded the Express yourself?
Yes, I did.
What do you remember about doing that?
I remember that it was a hell of a height, and I really bruised my feet jumping. Well, a lot of other people did the same. You had to get over your own rails. The handrails were there to protect you at sea. And so you had to get over that, and then you'd got to get across this space where the side of the Prince was making an angle with the Express or the Electra or whatever thing. Ours was the Express that saved the people from the Prince mainly. And, you've got to leap that distance. And I think there were one or two who dropped down in between. I mean, you took the biggest leap you could that would land you there. Of course you did, if you possibly could. Then I remember getting on to
the Japanese still attacking at that
No.
point? They'd stopped.
No. I said, and we always heard that. But this was never confirmed. Someone, I don't know who it was who said it, that the Japanese had signalled... we will allow you to. We won't fire anymore. We'll allow you to pick up survivors, or something to that effect. The poor express was absolutely overladen with people. I mean, hundreds of us, and they tried to give us all a tot of rum, which I think they managed to do, and then a cup of tea and things like that from the galley on the express. Not very long before the prince went down, of course, it was freed completely. You know, it was all cut and freed, and then. You know, they tried to pick up some of the people who were swimming, trying to swim in oil, which killed a lot of people, of course. They were dying for several days afterwards in Singapore, having, you know, got it into their lungs. and then, of course, suddenly there were some British planes appeared, and they were booed from the people in the sea. I remember that. They, you know, shouted, you know, why didn't you come before, and all sorts of things.
They were RAF,
yes. But they were, and I'm trying to think what the make of the plane was. You know, they weren't very modern, because it didn't look as if they'd got, you know, prepared as regards the Air Force. It didn't look as if they'd got the latest planes, you know, to combat the Japanese, because if they'd had some planes to break up those squadrons, that would have been marvellous. You know, that's why they got booed. You know, that was the first time any appeared at all. Of course, it was not their fault.
Now, where did the express take you, and what were conditions like during that voyage?
Well, the express went back very quickly down south, and then back across to Singapore, the naval base itself, and there we were sort of fed and watered and given beds in I suppose they were the naval barracks. My memory isn't always good, but we were able to and check on who was there and who wasn't. And of course we had lost our captain. That was a great loss, and a lot of us always thought that was a great shame, because he was so popular.
Captain Leach
was very popular, and also of course he went down with the Admiral Tom Thumb, you know, and I don't know about the people, the higher officers on the Repulse, what happened to them, but I do know that there were two or three of our higher officers lost, I think unnecessarily, because I didn't think you had to go down nowadays when you were perfectly fit.
What about your friends? Did you lose many of your friends? And I don't want to upset, I'm just asking, really. Were a lot of your friends killed in this?
No. From my mess deck, there were. Well, yes, never thought of it before. And that might have been a sort of proportion on the whole ship.
So 2 out of 9.
Might have been, yes. I should think it wasn't far out. I think the Repulse lost relatively twice as many as the Prince did. But you see, we were sort of hanging about floating for longer, and so.
Now, I'm not sure what the next thing you want to move to is then, because how did you get away from Singapore? Or is there a story?
Yes. In fact, that was quite out of the blue, and I was sort of what they call cushy or jammy again, because what happened was. That's the next thing. Because the Japanese were advancing down, they started to send our crews up to support the army up farther up in Malaya to stem the Japanese speed of advance, if not the advance itself. And so a great number of them were sent up to reinforce, and eventually, of course, they got taken prisoner. But I was down there. And they picked me as one of the six to help to man with another chap six machine guns on the top of CNC's office in Singapore. So that became my job, is to go and man this machine gun, which was a very old machine gun, and they all were on each successive corner, and two in the middle, you see. Anyway, that was the job that I was given then. I suppose later on I would have been sent up with the others, but I wasn't. And suddenly, after doing that job for not very long, at least I don't remember it being more than a day or two, I suddenly found that I'd been told to queue in a certain place, because you always had to queue, you know, for particular moves, to queue up with so many other people and such and such. I think the young chaps going in for commission, you know, who are on board, you know their name?
Midshipmen,
yes. I think they got the midshipmen together and quite a few others. And I was included again. And they said, well, we've got a ship waiting and you're going to go on board that. And it was called the Erin Pura. It was an old tramp steamer. But it was a very interesting thing for me. And we got on board this, and there were no bunks or hammocks anymore. We just had to lie on the deck and make yourself as comfortable as you could. And I remember one or two things about it. One was you might easily have a rat run over you when you were asleep at night, you know, not very pleasant. And also the other thing was, the only thing they could feed us on was goat stew. From morning and night, goat stew. We had this goat stew, and anyway, we survived it. And I remember the first day we got on board the Erin Pura, which could only do 8 knots. I think it was a Chinaman who was looking up to see a plane going up high, and I think he fell. I was told he'd fallen back on his head and killed himself. That was a good start on for his getaway. And then the crew of the Erin Pura were Lascar crews. And we used to hear them chanting and singing their prayers right into the night. And to get the meat for the goat stew, I remember they used to go into the pen of goats on the upper deck and kill a goat in front of all the other goats, and then just take it down below to the galley, and that went into the water, and that made our food for the trip. And anyway, it was successful, you can tell. It must have been, or else I wouldn't be here.
Where did you go?
We crept down the side of the, that top in. Is it Sumatra, wasn't it? Crept down there, and then we cut through into the Indian Ocean round Krakatau, you know, the crater there. That was quite an experience, really. And by then, of course, I'd got used to the tropical season, and we went off then to up towards Colombo. And Colombo, of course, you know, we thought, oh, there you are. We're 1,000 miles away from the Japanese now. And then I got a job, you know, in Colombo, cushy job. I didn't ask for these jobs, but I got them. My job was to take ratings from the harbour to the barracks, so that they could be swapped or whatever, you know, onto other ships. And we thought, oh, well, we're 1,000 miles from the Japanese, you know, we can take it a bit quietly now. But we couldn't, for one or two reasons. And one was that on Easter Sunday of 1942, I've got the right date, year, haven't I? 42, I was walking between the barracks. And it might have been one of the buildings in town. It wasn't the naval offices, because I wasn't working there yet. And suddenly, this was quite early in the day, suddenly there was all these planes appearing up in the sky. You know, it's like little hornets swarming. And of course the Japs had come again to bomb Colombo Harbour. And they were very fierce, and I was in a lighter. You know what a lighter is on? I was in a lighter on that lake in the middle of Colombo, and I had a sort of a grandstand view of all this. I got into there, in spite of having white gear on and all that, you know. I got in there, and these planes, I could, sometimes I'd see these planes, you know, having dived down to bomb. They were sort of trying to get away, and you could see the pilots in the planes ever so clearly. And sometimes you could see the tracer bullets going through their plane as they went across. I mean, they were ready for them in one sense, but of course they didn't. I don't think they. Well, they shot a few down anyway. That was something. But they didn't do an awful lot of damage in the harbour. The only ship that they sank, unfortunately, was the Tenedos that had been with us before, up off Malaya. But of course, what I hadn't said before, I should mention about those torpedo bombers. They came all the way. I mean, we had our Swordfish, but they wouldn't go very far. But these things that the Japanese have got, they came all the way from Indochina down, you know, hundreds of miles. I mean, people didn't think they could carry a one-ton torpedo all that distance, I'm sure. Not when, I mean, I'm sure it hadn't got round to the admiral who was in charge, that the Japs were that. They were very clever at concealing a lot of these developments that they'd made. They were very clever indeed. And they must have, really, when you think of Taranto and their observations, I mean, they must have been playing a double game, and they must have known it all the time. But you know, that doesn't, I must say this, that some of our people on board said, you know, they were always called, I'm afraid, they were often called yellow bellies by people in the Navy. And then I remember after the, they'd done this job, and the way they persisted in the face of fire or whatever, you know, there was, I remember one of the Geordies saying, nothing yellow about them bastards, you know.
Now, again, I'm conscious of pressing time, so yes. What happened after this attack on Easter Sunday?
Well, we feared then, they went round to Trincomalee and did some damage up there. They sank the Suffolk and Norfolk, down south of Ceylon, or anyway, they sank them, and sank quite a lot of other things on their way. And then, luckily, that was, by the way, it was, I believe, the Pearl Harbor fleet of Japanese carriers that did this attack on Colombo. I think they did one on Darwin as well, or, you know. But after that, we never saw, you know, they moved. We didn't know they were going to move, it really meant there was a reshuffle in the Indian Ocean, and I was very involved in this in a way from then on, because once I was in Colombo, of course, I was there for 2 years, and I changed over in the course of the first, well, after about 6 months, to doing meteorology.
Now tell me about this, because this is what probably we'll move on to this and then think. So what were you doing? What? How did you come to move on to meteorological duties?
Well, I was in the drafting office. You might think he's got all the cushy numbers. I couldn't help it. I didn't appoint myself. But I was in the drafting office, and one day a little sheet came round from the admiral at the naval offices or someone saying required a candidate for meteorology. And as I was the first person to handle the paper, I got the job. I mean, as far as I know, they probably posted it up. in the barracks, but I was the only person who showed any interest. A lot of them probably didn't know what it meant anyway. It wasn't long before I was switched to meteorology, and really they gave me a sort of carte blanche to train myself, which was rather odd because they were so busy in the Met Office there, and they sent me out to the airport, and I was in the tower and got to know all sorts of things about meteorology.
Now, what were those things?
Well, I got to know how to do a report. How to do a report, and how after that to plot charts with that particular report and lots of other reports stuck all over to represent what the weather was like at a given time. Is all simultaneous, say 9 o'clock in the morning or 10 or midnight, midday or midnight or whatever. They were all simultaneous, and in Ceylon, I think there were only about 20 stations anyway, Met stations, so it was relatively easy. And it wasn't long before I was roped into the Met Office in the Admiralty buildings.
I thought you said you were there for 2 years.
Oh yes, it wasn't long before I was working in there now. I was in Joseph's Barracks, St. Joseph's Barracks, which had been a public school, St. Joseph's Public School, until it was taken over soon after I was landed in Ceylon, and it was built up. At first I was in the Bristol Hotel with another rating, and we had this job of having a car, especially with a driver, to take ratings to ships and from ships, down to the harbour. The main reason was that a lot of the Cingalese started to leave when the Japanese had attacked. They thought they'd come again, so they went off to home up in the north or somewhere to get away from Colombo. So I was settled now in doing meteorology. And then after I'd been doing it
six months
I'd been doing it, and I'd be getting leaves up in the hills. Fantastic experience going up the mountain railways in Ceylon, and up to the camp where it was all cool and so on, or to the planters' estates, and being given a week's holiday up there, once every 6 months, that's all. And a report came in from the Maldive Islands. That would have been about February, I suppose. 43, yes. And all the upper air readings were wrong. We knew they were wrong, but so they said, well, it needs someone who can sort this out to be sent there. So they sent me down there on my own, down to, on a special boat. On a boat that went to the Maldives. And I was there for about 10 weeks. And my job was to sort out and get the upper air right, because the upper air was terribly important. I mean, the Maldives are, plonk in the middle of a huge area. And you've got to get it right there, really. And it was there more or less on the equator. It was less than a degree from the equator. And I was on the island of Gan at the bottom end. And so I was sending reports very frequently, much more frequently than I had to, because I loved the job. And I loved the little place where I'd been put.
Now, how do you take these things? Because you haven't actually said.
Sending up balloons and then following the balloons and watching which direction the wind is blowing at different heights as they go up. And we got them up as far as 30,000-40,000 feet, a lot higher than they actually needed. But of course it did tell them more about the weather than about what the planes were meeting lower down. So I found it absolutely fascinating. I could have lived there.
So you'd send up a weather balloon and then judge the speed of the wind.
You had a theodolite. You tracked it and you let it go up and up and up, and then you you could work out all the from readings. But of course, later on, I was to do this on board when the ship's moving as well. So, which was quite demanding, really. But I thoroughly enjoyed it. It was lovely hot weather. You could go for a dip when you liked on the reefs. And,
anything else other than the weather balloons? What else? The readings?
Well, I mean, all the readings you took. You took the temperature, the humidity, which was always high down there. You know, the only place you felt that it could dry off a bit was by the pool. You could. But I loved the Maldives, and it was very funny in some ways, because I remember there were these huts around the place in there, and one of them, they sent us a consignment when I was there. There weren't all that many naval people on the Maldives when I was there, probably at the most 8 or 10, and they sent us a consignment of Arctic wear. So we had great fun dressing up in all this Arctic wear, and on one or two occasions had a good laugh out of that. And then we also had things that the dear ladies at home had knitted, and I remember there were 6 of us got into one jersey. And I also remember there was a hut there which was stacked full of Marmite, nothing. Obviously, it was there in case the Navy had been. Going to be stationed there, but of course it seemed a bit incongruous that you get a hot full of Marmite. There were points of fun, and then my birthday came while I was there, and I
21,
yes. And I
21.
Was I 21? I forgot.
No, 23.
23 by then, yeah, and. I drank too much and contracted cellulitis, and then I had to be taken on board the hospital. It only took a day to happen. They got it, they got me right fairly quickly. And while I was there, the chap promised that I could go with him on a flight over Sumatra and so on. You know, it was a terrific journey. Whether he was joking or not, I don't know, but I think, if I remember rightly, he did go, and he didn't come back.
Now, so what happens next then? How long is it before you're sent to the Admiralty?
To the Admiralty.
Then?
I left. I was there altogether 10 weeks, and I must have got there about February. So I've never worked that out really. When I'd done my stint, and someone else had come to replace the chap who hadn't got it right before, then I was free to go back to Colombo, and I took my logbook with me, which I kept very carefully, and I've seen it since. I got to Colombo, and they wanted me to go down to South Africa, Africander 4 or 3 or something, to get a commission. And but I've always refused commissions. And so I said, well, it would only be in meteorology. So they said, yes, all right, we'll send you down to South Africa. So they took me. Down to South Africa. I went on 2 or 3 different boats to get there. And then when they got there, they said, I'm sorry, there's no Met commissions available. It's either an executive commission or not. And so I said, no, I'm sorry, I did say that I would only do meteorology as a commission. So they said, right, discharged forthwith to the United Kingdom. So I thought, good-o, I've been away for 2 years and 8 months, or something like that. So I got back home, and then it wasn't long before...
So when did you get back home?
I got back home in the December. I think it was December.
43.
December 43.